2%.
The 2%'s right over here.
Oh, hey, Jenna. I didn't know you shopped here.
Yeah. Anything to support local food. Know what I mean?
I definitely do. Though that's not the only thing you do in the name of Good Eats, obviously.
Well, true. I also host Eating Matters every Wednesday at 5 p.m., where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. Be sure to tune in.
All right, I gotta get the plug in there. I get it.
Yep, I'm hashtag shameless.
You know what else you can do to support the local food community, right?
Well, yeah. Make a donation to Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station.
That's right. And I gotta call you out on the whole local thing.
What do you mean?
Well, The Farm Report, A Taste of the Past, Japan Eats. Those are shows that take you around the country and the world.
I'll give you that. So how can listeners give their support?
It's pretty easy. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the big red heart in the top right corner. It's pretty easy from there.
Thanks.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Chris Johnson, who is the president of Sake Ninja LLC, a sake consulting firm based in New York City, and he has been actively educating people about sake, consulting for restaurants, and judging at notable sake competitions for the last 20 years. He's been featured in a number of national publications, including New York Times, Wine Enthusiast, Cosmopolitan, New York Magazine, and Black Book, as well as Japanese publications. So today, we'll talk about how Chris found his passion for sake, how he became sake samurai, how to pair non-Japanese food sake, and much more. Hello, Chris. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. So you're born and raised in New York, and how did you get into Japanese sake?
So my family has a four-generation relationship with a Japanese family in Tokyo. My grandfather was commander of the 7th Fleet and stationed in Yokosuka after World War II, closer to Korean wartime. And my mom lived in Japan for 2 years, and then my sister lived in Japan for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So as a little boy in my house, there was always Japanese items in the house. We had a big samurai helmet that I used to get yelled at every time I put it on my head, and we had visitors from Japan, so a lot of their family came to the United States for college, and on their college breaks they would come to my house for Christmas rather than going back to Japan. So from 3 years old I was exposed to Japanese culture. And then when I graduated college and was going, what should I do with my life? I applied to this program called the JET program.
So maybe I can tell us about the JET program.
So the JET program is a government program that's a Japan exchange and teaching program where people from different cultures come and not just teach English or Spanish or French to shogakko or elementary school and junior high school students and high school students, but also teach culture. So I was hired by a very small town in Kyushu called Kusumachi, where I taught English to junior high school and kindergarten kids for 3 years.
Okay, yeah, because JET is known for, like, before you go, they're like, oh, that's great, so have a great time. And then once you get there, you're just in the middle of nowhere. Nobody speaks English. No. You are lost.
I was definitely out there on my own when I told this story last night to someone, which is kind of funny that it just came up again, but we all meet in Tokyo for a training, and you learn a few things about how to teach English and how to interact with the students and culture shock and all that. And so 40 of us from Oita Prefecture all went down on the same plane. And 39 of us went to a meeting in Oita, and one of us went in a car and drove through the mountains and through the valleys and through the mountains and the valleys and rice fields and rice fields and rivers, and then ended up in a really small town, and that was me. So I was, I immediately got separated from the rest of the group, and 2.5 hours later, I was in the tiny town of Kusu, which is an amazing place, and I learned about Japanese culture and Japanese food and history, and that was what really turned me on to this whole future in the industry.
Right. So even if you were kind of exposed to Japanese culture since you were little, it's like, what is this?
I was not prepared for what I was brought into. It was amazing, though. It was I did every festival you can imagine. I harvested rice. I planted rice. My homestay family were farmers, so I got to interact with the soil and really understand a different lifestyle than what most people, when they go to Tokyo or Osaka or some of the bigger cities, which is also an amazing component of Japan. It's very different from what my experience was.
Maybe you were the only gaijin in the whole village or something like that.
Pretty much.
Right. That's great. That sounds really deep for 3 years.
Yes.
Right. This, you know, like you were there, and then probably you're drinking sake too, right?
Well, for me, initially, sake was part of a social meeting, right? Mm. We were in a town office, so I worked in the Board of Education and was based in the town office. So oftentimes, especially not just in the cities but in the countryside, you have many work events, or we call them enkais, or night parties. And so I was exposed to quite a bit of sake through that, but I wasn't exposed to sake in a manner of, let me smell it, let me taste it, let me think about it. It was, you know, kanpai. And, you know, you hand your cup to the senior, and you pour it for the senior, then he drinks it, then he hands it back to you, and you drink it, and you keep going back and forth, and you're interacting socially, which is a very interesting component of the small sake cup in Japan, that, you know, you're constantly filling it so that we're paying attention to each other and noticing our guests. But sometimes when you're the new guy at a town office party, you have to drink a lot of sake.
You cannot say no.
There's no word no. It's yes. Until they say no, you keep saying yes. So I was exposed to lots of sake, but there wasn't very much sake that was super high-end. I was exposed occasionally, but most of my experience was very good quality, like Junmai or Futsushu.
So then you didn't have much interest in sake when you were in Japan?
I didn't necessarily have the interest level that I have now. I think the really, for me, my aha moment, in the industry, we love aha moments because we want to give someone else that moment of, oh, wow, that's amazing, right? Whether it be food or drink or cocktail or a new flavor.
Yeah.
For me, it was, I was, after 3 years, we were wrapping up, and I had what they call in Japanese a sobetsukai, or a farewell party. And one of the presents I received was a 1.8 liter bottle of Daiginjo from Kokonoe Town's Yatsushika Brewery. It was his top level. At this point, you know, I knew sake, but I didn't know what quality sake was. And I'd also had 3 years worth of stuff. I'd already packed everything. I was ready to go home. And I looked at this bottle and I went, wow, that's going to be hard to get home. So in my internal Japanese essence also felt, this is a beautiful present. Let's share it together.
Oh, nice. Right?
So let's all drink it together. So we poured out cups for everybody, and we said kanpai, and I sipped it, and I went, what? Where was this for the last 3 years? I turned to my friends and was like, why did I never drink this? And they're like, well, we don't know. We don't drink Daiginjo very often. You know, we drink this one. So I had the Daiginjo, and I went, this is amazing. So I promised myself that I would go home to the U.S. and learn about restaurants and learn about sake. So that's where my real education of sake came when I returned to the U.S.
So that farewell gift changed your life.
Changed my life. Yeah, it totally changed my life. Put me in a whole new direction of what my career became.
Right. So the after teaching English for 3 years for kids, so you came back here, and then I heard that, you know, you said it in restaurants, but you did prep cook work at a Japanese restaurant called Katsuhama. So you thought of becoming a chef and then doing some sake business part of it?
I had initially planned on, when I was coming back to New York, three friends in Oita. One was a Japanese gentleman who owned the restaurant and bar we used to go to in Oita City. Another friend was from New Zealand. And the three of us decided we wanted to open a restaurant together in Auckland. So I said, I'll go home and learn restaurant business in New York, and then we'll all meet up in New Zealand later. New Zealand never happened, but so my agreement was to come back. I never had any restaurant experience before this. I had met a friend who worked at Katsuhama on a flight from New York to Japan, and we sat next to them and we started talking, and you know, that we kept in touch. And when I said I was coming back, I said, oh, I want to get into the restaurant industry. Do you know any links? And she said, well, I could probably get you a job as a prep cook at Katsuhama. And I said, that's where I'll start then.
Wow.
So I started out doing, you know, carrot ginger dressings and tonkotsu sauce and tugo sushi. And so that was the beginning of my career. And they had sake at Katsuhama, but I hate that word old, because now it says I'm old because it's 20 years ago. 20 years ago, it was the classic, you know, Otokoyama, Suishin, Onigoroshi, like the ones we all knew of, those four that were kind of everywhere in the staple Japanese locations. And I was like, okay, learned a little bit about it, and then went on to another job with a chef that ended up being the chef at Bond Street it was a bar called The Sushi Bar. And that's where I first met Kazu Yamazaki and Hiromi Yuchi, from two different importers that were bringing in higher quality sake. And that was the beginning of a continued aha moment of, wow, there's so much good sake out there. And it was amazing.
Wow. Okay. And then I'm sure being, you know, working in the kitchen, you'd learn all those taste profile. So maybe it contributes to your work now.
Developing your palate in every way helps you get better at your own specific job. So learning how to taste food helps you learn how to taste sake. And learning how to taste wine helps you learn how to taste food. And all those little sensory notes you have to pick out help in every level. So working as a prep cook and getting into that side of the kitchen did help develop my palate.
Right. Because I don't know if you were in the kitchen, but you worked at Balthazar, Bond Street, Town and Tom, and about 60. It's like all those fashionable, good restaurant.
I was front of the house for all those places. I wasn't in the kitchen anymore back then. But then, you learn a different aspect of it. So there I was focusing more on wine and cocktails, and was creating cocktails and working on wine lists and sake lists for Bond Street, and again doing the wine list at the other places, and again developing and understanding my palate and learning how to pair.
Right.
When you're in the front of the house, you get to have the benefit of the wonderful food that the kitchen creates, but you also get to take all these wonderful beverages and wines and sakes that the producers create, and then you can marry them together and have that even higher level of experience.
Right. You're going to talk about your judging job, but, you know, I think right now sake is kind of deemed as a part of extension of wine. So that experience in non-Japanese restaurants would really help to do your job, right, as a judge,
It helped to develop, again, developing my palate and allowing me to understand what great things in sake help elevate this non-traditional foods and pairings in those abilities. It's a really fun... Sake is an amazing beverage, right? There's umami in it, and there's all these other things that we don't always get with certain wines, and then it's lower acidity, so it can play with food in a totally different way. The dance is different, right? It's a totally different dance that sake has with the food than what a wine would have. And so, you know, those different dances create a different energy and create a different way of looking at it and enjoying your meal. So sake is a wonderful thing to bring into a dining experience when someone doesn't expect it. Because sometimes people react like, oh, I don't think that, really? You're going to sake? And then you pour it for them and you say, taste the food, taste the sake, let them come together in your palate, and then they get it.
Right. Wow, sake can dance tango.
Yeah,
waltz,
it certainly can.
Right, so speaking of the pairing, so in 2002, you opened a modern Vietnamese restaurant, Bao 111, and also in 2003, Bao Noodles, which focused on regional Vietnamese home cooking. So why Vietnamese?
Vietnamese, interesting enough, when my partner, Chris Andrews, and I decided to open a restaurant together, we went to visit a space on Avenue C and 7th Street. And it was a Vietnamese restaurant at the time. And we went to we wanted to feel the energy of the space, right? Mm-hmm. Like anything, there's energy. And so you want to go in and feel the energy of the room. And if we went in and the room didn't feel right, you're like, maybe we shouldn't do it here, right? Because it isn't just location. Sometimes it's how you feel and what you think you can do and the energy of the space. So we went in and we sat down and had dinner. And the chef was Bao Michael Hun. Mm-hmm. And he created some food. And the wine list wasn't great. The refrigeration was all weird, but the food was amazing. Mm. The food was so good. And my partner had just come back from 9 months in Vietnam. Mm. So I looked across the table at him and one of our investors, and I said, I know we were thinking French or Japanese, but how do you feel about Vietnamese? And he went, I think that's a good idea. Right. So we took our knowledge of other things, right? Wine and high-level French cuisine and, you know, working at Balvasar and some of these higher chef, quality chef restaurants and saying, hey, look what we can do. Right. Let's take our skill set and help elevate the food that Michael's already creating. Mm. And then let's take our experience in other beverages and see what happens. Vietnamese cuisine and sake is an amazing pairing because there's so much fresh and bright flavors in Vietnamese cuisine. And there's the herbaceous notes and there's the fresh Thai basil and other herbs that we interact. And sake really grabs a hold of those flavors and helps elevate them.
Right. And other things like fish sauce or shrimp paste, soy sauce, those things are
umami-driven components that really help play along with that umami-pushed food. So when we have that sake to pair with it, it's really a compliment. And I was excited that it was an opportunity to take sake to another level and show how good we can be with a cuisine that's not traditionally Japanese.
Interesting.
And totally different flavors.
Right. Yeah, it's like even you are familiar with sake, you tend to think, oh, Japanese restaurant, drink sake.
Right.
If you go to Chinese, drink something else. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So that you broke the wall.
But you're trying to break down that wall and have people react differently. And when they have it, even for one of my very first pairings at Bao 111 with a bunch of brewers that had come over from Japan. And one of the brewers was Kamoizumi. And Maigaki-san, Mrs. Maigaki, is a very... She's a very accomplished chef. And, you know, her husband has a great palate, and so they...
I got lucky. I went to their home.
I had food.
It was the dreamiest experience at Sake Brewery.
Me too. I had dinner there with her, and it was one of the greatest visits I've ever had, and the food was brilliant. So when I did the pairing at my restaurant, I hadn't been yet to see them, but they'd come, and it was the first time they'd come to New York, and they were, you know, all excited, and I did a pairing of the shusen with a smoked duck. And they called me over beforehand, and they said, you know, pulled off the side, like covered the mic, and went, I don't think that's going to work. And I said, okay, I understand that. I respect that. I said, if at some point someone complains about it or has a comment about it, I will stand up in front of everyone at the restaurant. Mm. I'll draw everyone's attention and say, that pairing was all me. Mm. I made that decision. You know, if you don't think it, if you're not enjoying it, it's please don't take it out on the sake. It's all my thing. But of course, before we served the restroom, I brought them both a taste and had warmed the sake slightly.
Okay.
And they sipped and tasted and sipped and tasted, and they looked and they were like, okay.
Thumbs up.
Go sell it. Thumbs up. We can do this. So that's some of the fun of pairing and thinking outside the box, is that you can even shock the people who create it.
Interesting.
And do some really fun pairing stuff.
Wow. I can imagine. Wow. Okay. So those things, experience, I think, led to something special. In 1999, only 3 years after you came back to the States, you proved your competence as a sake expert at the first international kikisake competition. Maybe you can tell us about that. What is the international kikisake competition, and how many people competed with you?
So it was a competition of about 160 Japanese sake sommeliers and then 10 people from outside of Japan that they could become international.
Only 10.
And 10 international and then 150 Japanese.
Right.
And I was, without sounding funny, I was kind of like the token white person from New York to participate in the competition.
Right.
It was through a company at that time called Sake Service Institute, and they created the competition. And so I went over with the, hey, Chris, would you be interested in participating in a sake sommelier competition in Tokyo? We'll fly you over. We'll probably do a couple brewery tours afterwards. And who says no to that? Mm. I get to go back to Japan? Right. Of course I'll go. not really knowing how in-depth the competition would be. Mm. I sat down and we had a written test,
okay.
A pairing test. We had to create a menu and then do a pairing menu, describe a restaurant, and then we had a live on-stage competition towards the end. And each stage I passed, and my friend who had organized me coming was like, I didn't know you were going to make it this far. And I'd say, oh, well, what is there something I should know? She goes, yeah, you need to come up with a cocktail. I was like, a cocktail? Like, yeah, you have to do it on stage for the final competition. You should have to submit your cocktail now. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me? You know, she was like, I didn't think you needed to know. So created a cocktail, got up on stage, did the final, and I ended up coming in third place out of all of the people involved.
Mm.
And which was great. It was it helped me understand that I did have a palate, right? When you're yourself and you're studying, you don't necessarily understand if you have a talented palate or if you have the ability to discern flavors and do all that. You learn as you're doing it. And so when I was exposed to that and got the opportunity to kind of understand what I could do, it really made me more confident and then allowed me to come back and continue to do the judging and the competitions that I do now.
Right. But did you expect you're going to go that far?
No, not at all. I mean, you always have confidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew at that point I had been pretty intently studying and tasting sake for 3 years.
Mm.
So was working at Bond Street and developing those menus and dealing with a lot of sake and watching sake get better.
Mm.
Sake levels kept growing. The quality of sake available in the U.S. kept getting better and better, and I was able to expose myself to this and taste a lot of it. So I felt like I had a good base, but right. I didn't think I was going to be able to be the top three with, you know, some geniuses in the sake field that I'm still friends with today.
So. Mm, amazing. So, and then to emphasize this, your competence, you became sake samurai in October 2012. What is sake samurai and why do you think you earned the title?
Sake samurai is an association that recognizes people who have made inroads in the sake industry, whether it be promoting it, educating about it, importing it, writing blogs, helping everyone understand the level of sake, some, you know, producing sake. There's many different people who have received the award. I mean, many. There's 75, I think, at this point, with this year included. So it's a great honor, and it's a compliment to say, you know, you are one of the driving forces of the growth of sake and the continued understanding and education of sake. And so it was a great honor to receive that title. It made me very, very happy.
Mm. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So, let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Chris' recent judging experience at the major sake competition. So please stay with us.
And this one is called Classic by Soy. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events, such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Chris Johnson, a sake expert, educator, and a judge based in New York City. So you have consulted for many restaurants and developed many sake menus. So what is your strategy for successful food and sake pairings, including with non-Japanese food?
There are a couple different things that we utilize when we're pairing, whether it be wine or sake or beer or whiskey. And it's sometimes you're picking out parallel flavors, so flavors that appear in the food or the cuisine and flavors that appear in the beverage. Mm. That's one way of pairing. Then there's sometimes where you do contrasting pairing, where it's something that's kind of almost opposite, but it really makes it work, right? Mm. So opposites attract, or that kind of idea, that sometimes that works. And then my favorite pairing, which is much more difficult, is the conjoined pairing, or when the beverage fills in a spot where the food doesn't have, and the food fills in a spot that the beverage doesn't have.
Okay, complementary,
like within, not just as in similar flavors, but as in very much a complementary flavor. So that mango, pear, and passion fruit note in the sake really elevates that. Those like peach and pear and light notes in the salad, perhaps. So there's those little things like that you constantly work with. But I love pairing with cheese and doing non-traditional pairings because of the way sake can interact with the food. So when I create a list for a different restaurant, it's looking at, you know, having what kind of cuisine is it. So yes, we love daiginjo, the super elegant, you know, balanced, beautiful, high-level sake, but sometimes the cuisine, junmais are a better pair. So I might have more junmais on that list versus another restaurant where, like French cuisine, sometimes where it's much more elegant and refined flavors on the plate, I might have more daiginjo on that menu.
That's interesting. It's like we've been talking about, you know, wines becoming, I'm not sake becoming more like wine, you know, in terms of how people see it. But, you know, there's a difference. Like, for instance, you know, sake is less acidic in a way. And, of course, in terms of red wine, there's a tannin and there's no tannin.
Right, so there's no tannins, which allows you to do different things. So sometimes certain foods do want those tannins. And then it's a little bit more difficult to pair sake with it. So there's other things you can do with the sake to kind of change it. Sometimes heating the sake will change the complexity and the palate feel. Mm. So it'll help work with a different flavor profile. Sometimes what I do also, which is fun to work with our brains, because we're a very visual person, right? Our a lot of what we taste also comes through our eyes, even though technically it doesn't,
right?
But a lot of what we associate with it. So sometimes when I want someone to experience a really more earthy notes in their sake, I'll serve it in a ceramic cup on purpose.
Interesting.
Right? So the tactile component of your fingers touching earthy says earthy in your brain. So I've done this kind of a blind tasting thing at a restaurant in the past, where I poured the same sake in three different vessels and didn't tell them that it was the same sake, but poured it in three different vessels just to see how people would react.
Interesting.
And most people thought that it was a different sake.
It's just a package of all the five or even six senses.
Yeah, because you elevate it all. When you put that sake into a wine glass and twirl it around, all of a sudden it becomes more elegant and the different notes come out.
Right.
Versus the, you know, the ceramic notes or even just the regular ochoko, you have totally different flavor experiences. So it's a fun way to teach, but also to pair. So, you know, if I want the sake to be more subtle in the beginning, I can put it in a wine glass, or even put it in a standard sake cup, where you don't get a lot of aroma, but you do get a little bit of flavor.
Right.
So with a lighter dish to start, it might be in that small cup, and you sip it, and you're like, oh, that's perfect. And then the next course, I move it into a little bit more earthy, and then I can guide it differently by how temperature I serve it and what vessel I serve it in.
Right. Let me ask you that. You know, you mentioned the warming up sake changes the mouthfeel structure. How does it work?
I don't actually understand the science of it.
No, but you know how, you know, like, say I have this, like, but, regular sake,
right.
But by warming it,
the warmth changes a little bit of the texture on the palate, and warm beverages attack your mouth differently than the cold beverage, right? Mm-hmm. So your cold beverage generally tends to stay crisp and clean and stay in the middle of your tongue, whereas when it's warm, it encompasses your palate.
Like a rounder.
So it gets rounder, it gets more fuller in flavor when you warm it up. So that, again, changes our brain's vision of the textural component.
So maybe like a creamy food, you should warm up sake.
Right. Right. Like I like serving like a warm junmai with pasta dishes, like with a cheese-based pasta dish or a carbonara. Mm. Like I will take a junmai and warm it up, not hot, but just warm it up a little bit so that it interacts and it dances that lovely dance we're talking about, dances a little bit more with the food that way. Sometimes if you take that same junmai and make it crisp, cold, and put it next to that, that you know, carbonara or cheese and pasta dish, it falls flat because it's too
But clean. If you have a Caesar salad... Crisp and cheese on top, that would work.
Right, exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly. That's the fun of pairing.
So, well, now that because you are such a great educator, you can just give us quick sake 101.
Sure. I mean, the quickest sake 101, and try and be brief, you know, the first thing that I always want make sure everyone understands is that sake is a fermented beverage, right? And that's a very important component because it's not distilled, it's fermented, and the yeast is a very important component of giving you those esters and those aromatics and the flavor profile. The next thing that's important is knowing that, you know, quality sake is about very few ingredients, right? It's water, yeast, rice, and koji, right? When we have, you know, in the premium category, we can add a little bit of brewer's alcohol, and so I will mention that in the conversation. But then the next part about our Sake 101 is remember the main categories, right? Junmai, ginjo, daiginjo, and that the levels of sake and within that are there's great quality sake in every level, but when you're moving towards more elegance or more floral notes, you're moving from junmai to ginjo, getting a little more elegant, more little, like not necessarily sweetness, but fruit, floral notes.
Right.
And then daiginjo, which is the top level of elegance. And so as a customer and as someone I'm introducing sake first for, so sake 101 or some people are learning about it, I always say, start with ginjo, right? Because it's the easiest to understand.
Right. So it's the difference between junmai and ginjo and daiginjo. It's the milling rate.
It's the milling ratio,
rice,
the polishing ratio. So in the past, it used to be much easier to describe because you could say between 70 and 60, it's junmai and honjozo. And then between 60 and 50, it's junmai, ginjo, and ginjo. And then below 50, it's junmai, daiginjo, and
daiginjo. So 50 means 50%
remaining.
50%
milling remaining.
And then 70 means 70%
remaining. 70%
remaining.
So in the Japanese, when we describe it, it's what's remaining from 100% down to 50%. Mm-hmm. Another thing we like to say is think of sake rice kind of like a hard-boiled egg. And the yolk is pure starch.
Right.
And the closer you get to that yolk, the more elegant the sake becomes because there's less things to interfere with the yeast doing their job.
Right.
Proteins, amino acids, fatty acids, lipids all kind of inhibit fermentation. Sometimes I make a reference to this. Think about it, it's kind of like chaperones at a high school dance. Right? The chaperones are there, and so the kids aren't really dancing, but the chaperones go away, everybody starts to move. So if we can get rid of those inhibitors, then the yeast can really show what they can do, and that's when you get those layers of beautiful elegance that happen in a daiginjo.
Right, but at the same time, that outer side contains a umami and there's some personality of the rice and terroir.
So it can be characters. That's why junmais can have different levels of character. Like some oftentimes, you know, when I think of a sake that's got a little bit more depth, a little bit more character, I'll say junmai because some of those other flavors, those earthy notes, those rich notes. And when you get more elegant, which is a different kind of character, when you mill away, that's when you get your daiginjos and your ginjos. So everything has its own place. There's a reason for all levels of sake. We, you know, some people will say daiginjo is the greatest and that's what you should drink. And for me, I think daiginjos are amazing. They're like really beautiful Burgundies or high-end Bordeaux, but I don't want to drink that every day.
Right.
The sake that's in my fridge or that's in my glass more often than not is a junmai or a Kimoto style or something to that effect that's not so elegant and fancy. It's more classic and enjoyable.
So it's a different preference or the styles. Right. Okay. All right. So the other thing I'm always wanted to ask, so the sake cocktails, You know, I'm sure you developed many cocktail recipes.
I've done a few in the past.
So what's your thoughts on that?
Listen, taking a beautiful Daiginjo and putting it into a cocktail is not what I recommend. Mm. In the beginning, when I was first trying to get people interested in sake, especially outside of Japanese restaurants, there's other ways to get them to talk about or get them to try it. In the very beginning, I used to infuse sake with flavors that I found that occurred in some of the other sakes I tasted, but not necessarily an everyday common. So, you know, taking a little bit of lemongrass or taking some herbs or, you know, taking cucumber and rosemary and infusing it into a sake and then having someone try that, or even pineapple and serving it to you and you taste it with the pineapple, you're like, wow, that's delicious. And I say, oh, okay, hold on a second. And then I grab a sake that actually doesn't have any infusion in it and pour it for you and you taste it and you go, oh, wow, that's delicious. And I'm like, okay, now I took you from someone who said you don't really like sake to, oh, that's good, to, wow, now I'm drinking sake. Mm. So as a bridge to get to sake, I don't want anyone to ever take really high quality sake and throw it into a cocktail just to throw it into a cocktail.
Right.
But if you're saying sakatini or you're saying sake cocktail, the word sake's in it. Now, again, it's not, I'm not saying this should happen every day, but there are ways to help develop people's understanding of it. So, you know, I'll take sometimes in the summertime just to make something a little bit lighter, I'll, you know, muddle some mint and make a lemongrass syrup and then add some, you know, light, crisp, clean sake to it.
Mm.
And it's, you know, a light alcohol summer type drink that's not too heavy, but crisp, clean, and delicious.
That makes sense. Right. Okay. So it's like mixing a high quality sake. It's almost like mixing Coke and first gross Bordeaux kind of thing, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Not recommended, but as one of my my favorite brewers, who unfortunately passed away recently, at Yoshinogawa, he said that I make the sake, but once you buy it, it's yours. So I can no longer tell you what to do with it.
Right.
So if you want to put it on the rocks, or you want to put soda in it, or you want to squeeze a lime into it, that's how you enjoy it.
Right.
That makes me happy. I make it in a certain way. I'm going to tell you how. I'm going to tell you how I would prefer you enjoy it.
Right.
But you bought it.
Yeah.
It's yours.
Well, Yoshinoga, I think, is like a 19th generation old brewery. So
yes, very old
brewery. They say yes. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like, he used to drink his Gokujo Ginjo on the rocks.
Oh.
And all his friends in the brewing industry were always like, why would you do that? Why are you putting it on the rocks? And then he'd pour it for him and serve it to him on the rocks. And they'd go, oh, wow, that's pretty good.
So there's no rule.
There's never rules. There's always recommendations. And I say the same thing to my guests at the restaurants I work at. I go, I recommend that you have it this way. But if you want this sake warmed up, I'll happily warm it up for you. I would suggest you have it this way. But again, you're the one who's enjoying it.
Right.
I'm just here to help educate and open your mind to other ideas. But if this is how you want to have it,
right,
I'm not going to tell you no.
Interesting. Also, I think your preference keeps changing, too.
Yes.
The more you experience.
The more you experience. And then, again, different times a day, different times. Where are you in your meal? Right? I mean, there's plenty of Daiginjos that taste amazing warm. I had an experience when I was in Niigata at a brewery where we went to a restaurant. And throughout the meal, we had 5 different Daiginjos that were all warmed. And for how long were you always told, don't heat Daiginjo?
Right.
You should never do that. Yet this is a brewery that's been around for a long time that's warming their Daiginjo because it actually complemented the cuisine and it tasted fantastic.
Okay. So again, no rules.
No rules.
Right. And so I heard that you just came back from Hawaii to serve as a senior judge at the U.S. National Sake Appraisal. So what is it and how important it is for is it for sake producers?
The U.S. National Sake Appraisal was created 16 years ago, kind of as an opportunity to involve both Japanese judges of, you know, very well-respected senseis, and then generally 5 American or non-Japanese palates. That doesn't mean that it's not necessarily a Japanese person, but it's someone who's living are working in the U.S. so that we have a different take on what sake, what makes good sake and what doesn't. We judge based on this, very similar to the way the Japan competitions place. So, you know, aroma, balance, overall taste, and then overall impression. And for the brewers, it was always something interesting because they wanted to see what the American palate or the non-Japanese palate, the Western palate was looking for in a sake. What sakes did these five judges think were better? So the points is overall, whether it gets gold, silver, but we can see in the companies that aren't available in the U.S. Like most of the U.S. National Sake Appraisal, I think over 50% this year was not items that weren't available in the U.S. yet.
Okay.
So it's like a testing ground for many of them. And we try and give back, I mean, I say we, it's not, I don't run the competition, I'm just a judge, but
not as yet.
as a judge, it's to, they like to be able to provide the brewers with information and understand. And I always tell guests at the events where you get to taste the things we've judged, like the Joy of Sake, that even if it didn't get a gold or a silver, it doesn't mean that it's an inferior sake. Sometimes sakes that are bold and big and impactful can score in a certain way, and then other ones don't score as well necessarily, but it doesn't mean that it's not a great sake. As many people say, and there have been a few haiku written about it, that there's no such thing as a bad sake.
Depending on how much you drink sake.
Exactly.
Right. But I heard it's about 350 sakes.
This year there was 408.
Oh, wow.
So 408 sakes over 2 days.
Mm.
We taste every sake. And then there's a round two. So approximately 624 tastings over 2 days.
Wow. Yeah. Well, your tongue may be numbing.
Gets a little tired. Right. You got a lot of focus. You know, you're expectorating and then sipping water and then little green tea and apples to kind of reset your palate.
Interesting. So, but, you know, like you said, there's no right. You know, the price is like the better, higher the better. But there may be some trend reflecting in the market.
It lets you know what, because overall as a group, you know, what flavor profiles are moving in what direction and what sakes tend to score better. And that happens as well in the Japan competitions and in the IWC, International Wine Challenge for sake as well. You can kind of see where all of our palates change constantly and what we like changes and then what the market is making. Junmais have slowly become becoming a little bit more Ginjo-esque lately.
Okay.
Right? And so there's that. That's an interesting conversation that we have with the fellow judges and say, you know, is that a trend that they're doing in Japan or is that something that people want to see happen? Like for me, I think I always, when a Junmai tastes too much like a Ginjo, I mark it down 1 point.
Because it's not the uniqueness.
It's not Junmai.
Right.
I mean, it is Junmai, but it's tasting a little bit more like a Ginjo. So for me, that's a Ginjo. I don't beat it up, but if it was, you know, a two, it becomes a 2.5.
Interesting.
Right? So you mark it down just a little bit. And that's me. Not everybody does that, but that's my own, you know, thought process on it.
So, like, you know, the Californian wine, it to be bigger, bolder, more alcohol.
Right.
But then it's kind of started to be more kind of like suppressed in terms.
Right. Well, it's changing. And then that's our palates get more developed as well. And so when you learn to understand more flavor profiles in sake or in wine, it's the, you know, what wines did we start out with? Wines were Merlot and Chardonnay and fruity and fruit forward. And now, you know, we sell more and more of Cabernet Franc and other expressions, though, you know, Loire Valley wines and things as such that are developing, right? Sake will do the same thing, right? I think as more and more people get to know sake, think about, you know, everyone says, I don't want a sweet sake, right? And then you have to ask them, well, what do you mean? Because sakes all have different expressions, and the only real sweet sakes are truly, truly sweet are going to be your nigoris or your, you know, purposely sweet sakes. Nigori is still a very popular style of sake in the U.S., and obviously that's pretty sweet, but that's an easy entry for someone, right? That's why also Ginjo tends to be an easier to understand. You have those floral notes, you have those fruity notes. So for someone who's a novice to it, that's the easiest thing to approach. If you give them a funky, earthy, you know, depth of flavors like a Kimoto Junmai, that might scare you away the first time, right? But once you understand it, and then I can say, here, this is what we're having with food, let's have this sake. Now you taste it and you go, wow, that's amazing. But if it's the first time you taste it, Ginjos tend to be a little bit easier to understand, and we often guide people to Ginjos as their first expression. But again, depends on the guest's knowledge. So if you're a wine drinker, I will always ask you, and one of the restaurants I was working at, I would always ask the guest, what kind of wine do you like? Mm. What wine do you drink? If it was red, what would it be? If it was white, what would it be? And then that helps me know where I should take you in the sake realm.
Mm. Okay. So speaking of what kind of sake is selling in the market, I mean, you do consulting a lot at restaurants, right? So,
I mean, I think for me, the trend of sake is obviously we're doing great with the Ginjo and the Daiginjos and the elegance, and people like that beautiful flavor profile. But what seems to be resonating more and more with foodies and people who are looking for something to really complement their cuisine is this move towards Kimoto and Yamahai style.
Mm.
I personally love the depth that those sakes create. And I think every style has its place, and we need to have all those different styles. But I see that moving a little bit more in that direction of layers of flavors, more depth.
Because people are more experienced in drinking sake in this country.
Because everybody's palate's getting better and understanding sake more. And so when you look for more, what do you want? You know, what gives you more depth and layers of flavors is where we're headed. I think sake is a brilliant market. It's continues to grow every year, you know, 11%.
Right.
If not more every year, besides an occasional down blip because of economy. But in general, sake is continuing to grow and getting bigger and bigger. More and more people are exposed to it. And once you're exposed to sake, you never stop.
That's what I know. Right. I'm curious, though, that, you know, you just described what's selling right now as a trend. But then at the competition, you know, the appraisal, did you see there's a consistency between what people judged, awarded the prize, and what people drinking in the market right now?
Kimoto's did pretty well in both competitions. They tend to do well, but it's just like, it's similar to anything. There's within that style or Kimoto Yamahai style sake is, you know, you're judging them, and then within that you're elevating or evaluating them as to, you know, where they stand in that
right.
spot. One of the hardest things about judging, and this is true of all the judging competitions, is that when you're judging that many sakes, whether it's 100, 200, 300, or even 50, sweetness kind of tends to win a little bit. So sakes with a slightly higher sugar content tend to do better, especially later in the competition. Because our bodies always love sugar as much as you say, I don't like dessert. Yeah, you do.
There's another stomach for that.
You know, you need that sugar. Your body operates off sugar. So sometimes that affects the style. But I do believe that as we continue to grow sake, I think those older styles and some of those unique components of sake will start to come out more and more and more.
It really shows the maturity of this market, right?
Yeah. I mean, New York, London as well. I mean, all over the world where people are getting more and more into the challenge of sake and the love of sake, which I think is a great thing. You know, it's not just, we've moved so far from, you know, the $5 pitcher of hot sake or you know, the all you can drink hot sake with your sushi meal and those things. We're moving so far away from that. And I think that's fantastic. We've been able to grow the sake culture in this country very, very quickly. I mean, over probably 40 years, you know, between the first importers to now and the layer and level of quality that is now available in the States and the clientele that's buying it is amazing.
Well, speaking of, you know, there are American sake producers, right? How do you see their quality, their motivation, their whatever?
I think it's great. I think anytime you can get more interest into a beverage and have people that are seeking out to brew sake in the U.S. There's people here that have gone to Japan to study sake and then come back and make sake here. I think it builds a bridge to the Japanese products. One of the hardest things about sake in America is that it's quite expensive. Right? When you start getting to the quality level sakes, it's a big price tag. And it's hard for someone who doesn't know a beverage to go out and spend $22 to $30 on their first bottle, right?
It's risky.
It's risky. You know that if you know a little bit about wine or you have a trusted wine store, you can go in and get three bottles of wine that are quite good for that same price of one bottle of sake. So I think with the development of, you know, these great people brewing in the United States and doing some of the unpasteurized sakes and some of these other expressions, we're going to get people a chance to try these, try sake at a reasonable price point, and be able to really go, wow, Now I want to go buy that Daiginjo because I understand what it is. So I think the more and more we have that growth of sake here in the U.S., I think it's going to be a great thing. Plus, United States or quote-unquote American sake doesn't have to taste exactly like Japanese sake.
Mm.
It can have its own character. It can have its own thing because our cuisine is different than Japanese cuisine. So make it so all beverages were originally made to pair with their food, right?
I mean,
we've created now beverages that are just made to be beverages. A lot of Californian wines and things were created because this was a certain style you were looking for. But if you go back historically and look at wine regions and what wines are made in Alsace versus made in the coast in Muscadet versus other places or Basque Country, the wines reflect the food.
Mm-hmm. It's right? terroir.
So it's terroir. Mm. So sake, and here in America, as we make it, should emulate Japanese sake and follow the rules.
Right.
But it can taste a little bit different and be a little bit bolder or different based on our cuisine.
Right. Yeah, we had a guest, Todd Bellamy, from Dovetail Sake in Boston, and I think episode 36, and his sake was amazing. So it's very fresh because it's nama.
Right, bright flavors, but again, it is expressing his, it's his sake.
Right, Boston. Right?
So it's his thought process, and that's what's great about it, is that experience what he's putting in a bottle and enjoy it, because it's, like I said, all sake is good.
Right. Okay. So where can we find your updates, your projects?
Right now, I am working at the Waldorf Astoria at the restaurant called Le Chien, which is their fine dining Chinese restaurant. I'm working on the floor as a manager and sommelier, doing sake pairings and Chinese rice wine pairings as well as regular wine.
Wow.
I'm consulting with a few different distributors and importers to educate and help move brands into other areas of the United States.
Mm.
And I'm going to continue to do that.
Right. That's exciting.
You can always find me at The Sake Ninja on Instagram and Twitter.
Okay.
That's where I am.
Sure. We'll find you. Right. But keep us posted.
I will.
Right. You're really kind of a cheerleader of sake.
I love it. And I will always be cheering for it for as long as I can.
Great. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Chris.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can sign up for our newsletter to get fun updates and event information at the bottom of our homepage. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And today's show was made possible by Corin, and our engineer is David Tadasiore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.